As you probably know by now, Marcia Rader Brantley disappeared in spring 2009, but her husband did not report her missing. It wasn't until about 6 months later that her hairdresser contacted law enforcement and kept pushing until someone took her seriously. In the past episodes, we've examined the timeline of Marcia's disappearance, as well as conducting an in-depth profile so we'd understand her personality and character. Today, as long promised, we are going to start the educational side of the podcast and dig into the academic research. Welcome to Targeted, True Crime Podcast. We tell stories of those who were targeted by abuse and investigate cases of family violence using academic research to interpret the events. As a college professor, I think we need to stop making family violence a secret. It's time to tell our stories, use our experiences to help, heal, and provoke change. Targeted discusses sensitive information about abuse. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. Before we begin, let me thank all of you who reached out to me in messages and emails. I am so appreciative of you. It makes me tear up to have so many support me, even though you were going through similar emotions yourself. I think it's amazing how the podcast world can become like a little family or support system helping each other. Thank you. As we start to delve into the study of emotional abuse, we have some challenges. It is not as well-researched as physical abuse and does not have well-delineated definitions. Emotional abuse in a marriage might not be observed by others, and our best research comes from those who are in the process of leaving an abusive relationship or successfully left one. Marcia never spoke with anyone about abuse from Donnie. She never left him, and she was never in the process of trying to leave him. I asked every friend, every relative, and every acquaintance. No one reported seeing or suspecting physical abuse. Family, however, did discuss how they felt Donnie was responsible for isolating Marcia from them after she married him. This leaves us with more interpretive work, speculation, than I've done before in the podcast. For today, we'll use the academic research to discover some guidelines and then apply the knowledge gleaned to Marcia's case. To be clear, I am not diagnosing or stating absolutes. I am making inferences. Let's define what we mean by emotional abuse. I'm going to use the term psychological abuse and emotional abuse interchangeably throughout the episode. It is, by definition, not physical abuse. And I know that sounds really obvious, but emotional abuse would be something that does not involve physical action. Early studies in domestic violence often relied on injuries in order to identify abuse, but later researchers realized that for many survivors, the physical injuries were short-term and less severe. Lenora Walker was one of the scholars who helped establish the emotional component in The Cycle of Violence, something we discussed back in Season 2. Psychological abuse generally has two major categories. The first is verbal aggression, which can be calculated using a measurement known as the Conflict Tactics Scale, or CTS, developed by Dr. Murray Strauss, which measures behaviors such as insulting, threatening, or yelling. I'll include the sources for all of the academic studies on my website if you'd like to look them up yourself. So the first category was verbal aggression. The second one examines influence or coercion. The measurement for this is often the Psychological Maltreatment of Women Inventory, or PMWI, as developed by Richard Tolman, which identifies strategies to control or isolate or hurt the other person by belittling them. Although we have these good measures to assess psychological abuse, there's not an accepted overall definition of what it is. I'm reminded of when the U.S. Supreme Court was on an obscenity case a few decades ago, and Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart wrote that he could not define hardcore pornography, but he knew it when he saw it. Emotional abuse is a bit like that. A definition doesn't do a good job of capturing all the different elements of what it could be, so it's best dealt with by cataloging particular behaviors. And so you will find various definitions out there, but they will be used and disputed by various researchers, and there's just not one good one that seems to encapsulate everything. But if we look at particular behaviors, then we can get a better idea of if psychological abuse is happening. The impact of psychological abuse is profound. In my own research, I spoke with women who had left violent relationships. Almost all of them mentioned psychological abuse, and I have a couple examples of things that they told me. One of the women I interviewed years ago told me, quote,
"I feel the emotional damage has the deepest scars and takes the longest to heal, because you lose your personhood. There were days that I felt invisible, because when I said words, there was no response to my words, so I would begin to wonder if I was even making sound."
Unquote. Another woman I interviewed said it this way, quote,
"What was really, really scary is the spirit murder. I would call it spirit murder. They belittle, they demean, they criticize, and then it's like sometimes it was like I didn't exist. I would go for hours with being totally ignored. The mental and spiritual and emotional abuses, in a way, it's harder."
Unquote. So even though it might seem to outsiders that emotional abuse is less damaging than physical abuse, survivors themselves may perceive it as more damaging. In past episodes, in other seasons, we've discussed the risk factors for domestic violence, which can be identified readily. Marcia Rader Brantley does not fit into many of the categories for domestic violence, though. For instance, two of the major ones are socioeconomic status and education. When we're talking intimate partner violence or family violence, people with a low socioeconomic status, particularly those who do not have enough money for basic needs, are at a greater risk for physical abuse. This is also true of education, in which people with less education have a higher risk for physical abuse. This doesn't mean that a lack of money or education dooms someone to abuse, because the correlation is not predictive in nature. We generally start our studies with a population of people, such as domestic violence survivors, and find out what similarities this group has. Lack of money and resources is one of the commonalities. Of course, abuse can happen to anyone at any level of income and any level of education, so we certainly cannot assume that people who are rich or well-educated do not experience abuse. It's simply that violence is more common among those with less resources or less education. Marcia was not in a low socioeconomic bracket, so she doesn't fit with this risk factor. Even though they had financial troubles before she disappeared, even if they had declared bankruptcy, she still had a home paid in full, and she could return to a full-time job fairly easily with her strong work history and abundant experience. Marcia had a bachelor's degree, meaning her education reduced her risk for being a victim of domestic violence. Even so, when researchers separate out physical abuse and emotional abuse, we learn that those risk factors we've discussed in the past only reliably apply for physical violence. They do not hold true for emotional abuse. So when we're talking about emotional abuse, we kind of have to throw out the window what we've learned so far and start from scratch. Not completely, of course, but we can assume that studies about physical abuse also apply to emotional abuse. There have been studies into emotional abuse that try to identify the risk factors. Some of them have looked at socioeconomic status and education to find out whether or not they're correlated, but it's not that highly of a researched area. They have not found, however, that low socioeconomic status or less education correlates with emotional abuse. There is one study that I found quite interesting, though, by Hornig, McCullough, and Sugimoto, published in the Journal of Marriage and Family in 1981. They did find a link, but it's quite different than that from physical violence. They found that when there is a disparity in education or occupational status between romantic partners, there is a higher risk for emotional abuse. Since this study included a large sample of female survivors in Kentucky who had male perpetrators, we'll use gendered terms as we discuss the study. But remember, abuse can happen to both men and women. This study just happened to study female survivors. Women who had more education than their male partner had significant risk for emotional abuse. Also, women who had a career with a higher status than their male partner were highly correlated with experiencing emotional abuse. The researchers called this status inconsistency, in which one of the partners had a very different status than the other. But they only found a correlation when it was the woman who had a perceived higher status, and then they were more likely to be targeted for abuse. A woman with a perceived lower status was not at a high risk for psychological violence. So to be clear, women with higher education or job status than their husband or significant other were more likely to experience psychological abuse. When it was reversed, though, and the men had the higher education or higher status job, then the risk for abuse was lower. So it actually reduced the risk when the status inconsistency was higher for the male than for the female. So a male with more education or a more prestigious job than the female romantic partner, he was less likely to perpetrate abuse. This was Marcia's situation. She was college educated and had worked in higher education for many years. She rose quite high in her field, and she was very well respected for her work. Donnie did not seem to be. I believe he graduated from high school, but found no evidence of further education. He did not seem to have a career as much as he had a series of lower-paying jobs. In the last years of Marcia's life, they had bought a handyman franchise, and Donnie was trying to be a business owner. He failed, though, losing money, causing him to consider filing bankruptcy. This puts Marcia into a higher risk category with a husband who had status inconsistency, meaning he had lower status than Marcia did. To compound it, Marcia had more money in addition to her higher job status and higher education. When her parents died, she was the only heir, and according to her family, the inheritance was substantial enough that she could live off the interest of it. Her parents were not big spenders, and her father had saved money from his job as well as from real estate. From what I intuited, there is a period of time in which her dad essentially flipped houses. He would buy a house, they would move into it, he would fix it up. Sometimes he sold it, other times he kept it and rented it out. And although she was married to Donnie, she seemed to control the flow of finances in many ways. It was more as if Donnie had to ask permission for certain things. Marcia held the house in her name only. She never added Donnie as the joint owner, even after 10 years of her marriage. This may have been a point of contention, although it comes from speculation from friends and family. Even those who liked Donnie thought he spent a lot of money. For example, someone told me he liked Ray-Ban sunglasses, which are about $100 per pair. After Marcia disappeared and people had access to the house, There wasn't just one pair of Ray-Bans, but a dozen pairs. Most of them were unused, just sitting around. He didn't just buy one pair of jeans. Donnie would buy 10 pairs of jeans. Early on in the marriage, it wasn't as much of a problem as it became. After a few years of marriage, rather than being able to live off of the interest, Marcia and Donnie had to siphon off the investment money to pay for expenses. By the time she disappeared, there was little to no investment left. One of Marcia's indulgences was that she loved cars, especially sporty cars. She personally did not spend a lot of money on a regular basis, but there were a few things that she was willing to spend it on, and a cute car was her favorite bling. A couple months before she disappeared, she had had to give up her sports car and was driving around an older clunker. According to Donnie in his 2013 deposition, the last time he saw Marcia, she left because he had told her that his handyman business was failing and he needed more money. They already had well over $100,000 dropped into the business, and it was hemorrhaging money. I was told Donnie still owed wages to at least one employee, and they had no more investment to comfortably sink into it to get this business viable again. When law enforcement finally became involved, Donnie told them that Marcia had kept $100,000 in cash hidden in the attic, which she took when she voluntarily left. He figured that was enough money for her to live on without ever contacting him again. Friends and family do not believe Marcia kept a hoard of cash in the attic. She was comfortable with investing, and she wanted to be able to live off interest, so it wouldn't have made sense for her to have that much money sitting around doing nothing instead of having it working for her by being invested. This status inconsistency is my first reason why I think Marcia could easily have been in an emotionally abusive marriage. With the severe financial problems seemingly caused by Donnie, it's logical to infer that the status inconsistency was dangerously high at the time she disappeared. When people talk about Marcia being a strong, independent woman, it is exactly those character traits that could have created the risk for emotional abuse because it led to her having higher status than her husband, which put her at that higher risk for emotional abuse. Think of it this way. A man who feels that he has lower status feels emasculated in some ways. He compensates by psychologically cutting down his wife. He belittles. He demeans. He controls her in other ways, such as access to friends and family. He makes her work for his affection, and when she is not doing it well enough, he punishes her. When she works at it, doing better, he gives little rewards. And sometimes he gaslights her. You don't love me enough because you won't let me buy that thing I want. You have a sports car. Why shouldn't I have the best top-of-the-line racing bike? Why shouldn't I get Ray-Bans? And they're on sale, so I'm going to buy enough to last me for 20 years, so I'm going to buy a dozen Ray-Bans. And if you loved me, you would let me do that because it's actually financially good because we're saving money because it's less if I buy them all now. Because many women with higher status inconsistency don't actually care about the status inconsistencies, they try to appease and stroke the wounded male ego. I'm using gender terms here again, because research only established the risk when a female had that higher perceived status. When the male had the higher status, the risk for emotional abuse is significantly lower. I don't think Marcia gave a hoot about these perceived higher statuses. She didn't care that she had more education than Donnie. She wanted him to succeed in his business endeavors. For a long time, I don't think she even cared about the perceived financial imbalance between them. But I do think she became distressed in the months before she disappeared that her inheritance was slipping away. While she shouldered some of the blame, it was more that she blamed herself for allowing Donnie to waste it. Putting together everything I've learned from my interviews, I think Donnie resented Marcia for her perceived higher status, and the disparity between them was increasing at the time she disappeared. This put Marcia at a higher risk for psychological abuse. Remember that risk factors are not predictive as much as they are descriptive. It doesn't mean that Marcia was destined to be psychologically abused. It simply means that she fits in a category of persons who are significantly more likely to be emotionally abused than other populations. And this leads me to the kicker. Do you know what? Women who are victims of psychological abuse are at a much higher risk to become a victim of physical abuse. Here is a quote from the Horing et al. Study that I've been using to talk about today. The authors say, quote,
certain status inconsistency, such as underachievement in occupation by the husband, or status incompatibility, such as when the woman is high in occupation relative to the husband, involve very high risk of spouse abuse, particularly life-threatening violence.
We put all this together. The research indicates that Marcia was actually at a high risk of her life being in danger, even though on the surface she didn't seem to be. If you find yourself in a similar situation to Marcia, I want you to trust your gut if you feel like status inconsistencies have encouraged your partner to engage in emotional abuse. Seek out help. With good therapy or even couples counseling, these types of things may be addressed and remedied. I'll warn you, though, that this aspect of domestic violence is not well known by many mental health professionals and may not be on the radar of those who work with domestic violence survivors. It's an outlier situation. It's not the typical one that professionals deal with all of the time. Even if others aren't familiar with it, now you know that emotional abuse is a risk factor for eventual physical abuse, even life-threatening violence. Next week, we'll look at another area of domestic violence research and how it might apply in Marcia Brantley's case. Join me as we remember Marcia and examine her disappearance to become better informed about domestic violence. Thanks so much for joining us at Targeted True Crime Podcast. If you're interested in my sources or research, I include a bibliography on my website, www.targetedpodcast.com. If you want to support the show, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and writing a sentence or two about what you like. If you want to connect on social media, I'll include links in the show notes. If you'd like to reach me via email, you can do that at targetedpodcast@gmail.com. Please stay tuned for promos at the end of the podcast and check them out if they sound interesting. As we end, let me emphasize that if you or someone you know is a survivor of domestic violence, you are not alone. There are resources available to you. I've included some contact information in the show notes and on the website about a few organizations. Leaving an abusive relationship can be one of the most dangerous times for a target, so I strongly encourage you to reach out for support. Getting help may be the hardest thing you'll ever do, but it will be worth it. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. Peace, my friends. Peace.